This is an oral history interview on the 3rd of June 2016 with Elizabeth Wells, archivist,
Tom Edlin, history master and Old Westminster,
and
David Thomas Gale, former headmaster.
David, I was wondering if we could sort of start at the beginning, as it were, and looking back, would the child David Thomas Gale have expected to end up as headmaster of Westminster School?
The answer to that is no, except that I had a beloved aunt who used to drive ambulances around the world and got married at St Margaret's, and she lived just round the corner, as it were, during the war. And I always do remember her saying to me, "You must become headmaster of Westminster School." Either that or a bishop, I think. I can't quite remember which was the thing. Well, it became less similar as years passed, I think, yes. So, it hadn't entered my mind at all, absolutely not. Neither had headmastering, actually.
Did your own school education give you any inspiration to want to teach?
It's odd. I mean, I think I stand in defiance of sort of everything that education is supposed to do, because I in fact, was at Sherborne and in the beloved West Country, and it was lovely, and it was absolutely awful. I mean, basically 5 years of being a kind of concentration camp. But concentration camps, if you survive, can be beneficial as well, I think. And so one learned to survive. My parents happened to live in France, so I saw them for one afternoon a year, apart from occasionally in the holidays. And yet it became, in a strange way, sort of embedded. I mean, I was the only person at the school who wished to study English at the university, so there was no provision for me in the timetable at all. I also decided, because I lived in France, I did French A-level, which you couldn't do in those days with English. So I did French A-level, and I was suitably cussed and wanted to do English, and I was really taught out of school for about a whole year. So it was, academically it was odd, but one strangely got used to the whole world of schools, I think, and eventually emerged. And when I went to university, I don't think that, I've thought vaguely of teaching, but I wanted probably to go and teach overseas, because I hadn't done national service.
And you could, I suppose, also have stayed in the university world. So you obviously made a conscious decision to go back to school teaching.
Yes. I regretted afterwards not having an extra year at Cambridge, I must admit, partly because I'd missed a couple of terms because of an eye problem. And so I hadn't really quite done my bit. And it was odd because I was there sort of post national service, which I hadn't done, so all my friends had done national service and I hadn't, and that's why I really thought that I needed to do something, roughly speaking, the equivalent of national service. And the then dean of my college, who was Bob Runcie, later to be Archbishop, wrote me a letter shortly after I'd left saying, "Off you go to the University of Delhi and teach there," at St Stephen's College, and complaining bitterly, I duly went, and was miserably unhappy for about 6 months, and then completely fell in love with the country and the people. And that teaching at university level with young men, as they were, because there weren't girls around in the university at that time, nor were there many other pink men, actually, was wonderful. It was in a way, it was something that I didn't feel I could replicate when I got back to the UK. And mercifully, I think I just about had enough wisdom to realise that I shouldn't stay on. While in a sense it was tantalising, as it often is, to be sort of offered things and so on, I sort of felt, well, no, I must come back and see what it's like back in this country, and then I got trapped.
Mm-hmm. It is fascinating how those lasting influences, your love of France, your love of India, mm-hmm. Really started at such a young age, you know, have lasted for
yes.
so much of your life.
Yes, I mean, it goes... I mean, both go back a very long time. I mean, my grandfather, whom I never knew, fought for an Indian regiment in the First World War. The first Indian regiment to turn up at the battles of Ypres, and most of them were wiped out, and then for their sins, the remainder were sent off to German East Africa, where he joined them from Calcutta. He was one of these Scottish men who went off to India with his wife and died before I... And then we, as a family, me aged a year and a half, whatever, in 1939, my parents sort of sold a house reasonably near Guildford, moved the family lock, stock and barrel to Paris, which wasn't a particularly timely occurrence. And so we got out again in a hurry in 1940, then went back in 45. So France has been there, as it were, as a sort of background all the time. And I suppose the contrast between post-war Paris and Sherburn, where you were beaten if you were seen talking to girls from the girls' school and that kind of thing, and the whole thing was operated in a kind of, I mean, they wouldn't get away with it nowadays sort of style. But very luckily, one was brilliantly taught by one or two sort of post-war teachers who'd sort of come into teaching as something valid to do post-war. So we had one or two brilliant teachers, and I think probably that sort of remained as part of the scene, and particularly when one turned up at Westminster.
Of course, you spent a certain amount of time teaching at Charterhouse earlier in your career.
Yes.
Where I think you left a very lasting impression on many of your pupils. What did you relish most about teaching there?
Well, it turned out to be wonderful. I mean, I didn't really give it much for thought, and then I came back from India, just actually, as my father died in France. And so I thought I'd better come back for various reasons, including sort of being around with my mama. And it so happened that Charterhouse had a vacancy at a rather inconvenient time of year, namely dead of winter, one of the worst winters in living memory, which I think was 62-63. And so I accepted the chance to go and teach English there, and never lived to regret it, actually. It wasn't they were interesting and difficult years, sort of 63-75, where just about everything was going wrong and the adolescent world was going wrong in a fairly magnified way. Yet I was actually appointed by Brian Young, whose daughter has much now to do with Westminster, and who has remained a sort of a distant but kindly sort of friend from afar. And he then promptly left and was succeeded by a man called Oliver Van Os, who was a sort of titan amongst headmasters. I mean, probably the last one to have got a fourth at Oxford and become a headmaster. Bachelor, by the time he reached Charterhouse, or widowed. And he was a sort of larger-than-life-size man who, if you got on well with him, which I was fortunate enough to do, was terrific. And I must say, whenever I was in a tight corner as a headmaster, which was fairly frequently thereafter, I used to shut my eyes and think firstly of an Indian village and secondly of what would Oliver Van Os do. And he always got it right. And the only occasion that I didn't do what he told me to do, I got it wrong, to oversimplify. But it was a very stimulating, it was nearer to Westminster than anything that I'd come across. A lot of very, very talented kids from vastly different homes, somewhat sadly increasingly dominated by money, it being where it is in darkest Surrey, but with a hell of a lot of educating needing to be done. Very fragile, uncertain of where they were going and what the point of existence was and all that kind of thing. And sometimes it involved going and lying down in front of railway trains on the first day that A-levels began, which happened to one of the most brilliant students that I taught there, who was a mathematician, actually, had argued himself into believing that that was the logical next step, which was all very well until his closest friend did it a fortnight later in the holidays, having seen the effect of it upon friends and parents and everything else. But it was, I don't know, one was a strange mixture of sort of India gave it an enormous perspective. I mean, the sort of things that one had seen and lived through there in what was still very close to independence sort of, in a way, put the kind of dimensions of problem, in a way, into a more manageable perspective. So I suppose one was a kind of sort of, as most of us teachers try to be, a sort of nursemaid and handholder and advisor about all sorts of kinds and conditions of things, and as well as doing the actual teaching. The teaching was very exciting. I was lucky. So much depends on luck. The head of English departed to become headmaster of a school elsewhere. So I was appointed quite young as the head of English, even in those days was a pretty major affair in the school, which was trying to build up its sort of academic whatnot. And then I became almost simultaneously a housemaster, because the housemaster also left to become a headmaster elsewhere. So one was given a lot of sort of confidence, in a way, by the headmaster. The English was terrific. I got very much involved in the, firstly, the setting and marking of exams, and then awarding A-level English and revising A-level English and sort of participating in various things which were to do with the pioneering of the sort of different approaches to teaching English, which have since then been turned upside down about 10 times, I think, so somehow more or less go on, as it were. So it was terrifically stimulating, and one made a lot of friends. And there were amongst, it was a school very much in the time of transition from being terrifically gamesy, totally dominated by games, and going on doing that well, because one loved playing games as well and everything else. But at the same time, there were some brilliant teachers. There was some very mundane teaching, but there were some wonderful teachers of English and history and other subjects, sort of in varying degrees, depending on where openings appeared, really.
The teaching clearly always mattered hugely to you, and as headmaster we always felt that teaching mattered enormously to you, and that's a wonderful example to set. I was wondering, which books did you most enjoy teaching, which authors did you most enjoy teaching, particularly to sixth form classes?
That's a very difficult question. I mean, the answer, probably oddly enough, is Chaucer, which I sort of took as a special subject at Cambridge, and strangely enough, sort of purveyed a little bit in India as well, which sounds very bizarre. But I think ultimately it was Chaucer and Shakespeare, really, which sounds a bit sort of old hat in a sense, but in a way, under the current debate that goes on about the perversity of sort of modern Shakespearean productions in the National Theatre and the Globe Theatre, where the director says how marvellous it is that she's never read any Shakespeare and so on. I think sort of trying to help people to understand and appreciate what's going on in both those spheres was better. The rest of it was sort of in a way easier. I mean, because I was sort of responsible for setting a little text, we could more or less teach what we liked and then got them set. And I actually, when I first arrived at Westminster, of course, we were still setting our own English papers and so on, which was splendid. I think that, and then that one had a very sort of free rein to do what one liked, really. A-levels, yes, of course, they mattered, but the whole business of league tables and grades and so on didn't matter, and you could still have good interviews at good colleges at Oxford or Cambridge or indeed elsewhere, and you'd get in almost regardless in a funny sort of way. It was easier, and therefore there was more time to sort of enjoy the academics without the sort of hectic pressures. And of course there wasn't, you know, the kids weren't taking four A-levels or five A-levels or six A-levels, they were just probably taking three, and that was that. And so they had time to actually learn and enjoy. We did a mighty amount of drama, which was thrilling too, actually. Not least because there was nowhere to do it. There were no sort of purpose-built theatres and that sort of stuff. So we just invented places, and it was all the more fun. Lord of the Flies and the Eton Fives Courts was good.
Was it a difficult decision to leave Charterhouse?
Yes, it was, actually. I mean, for various reasons. I mean, one is I'd been a housemaster for 4 years or so, which was probably the hardest thing that one had done, being in a sort of resident, in a boarding school, with purpose-built houses where each boy, as they then were, had a single study bedroom on the sort of Eton basis. The new houses at Charterhouse were built on that basis, and Oliver Van Oss's idea was rooms with views, and so each room had a view out of over lovely countryside. Because educationally, he thought that was good for them, but it was quite a demanding business, sort of wandering round of an evening, as one did every single evening, as it were, 60 individual, potentially troubled adolescents from the ages of 13 to 18 in a single study bedroom. So one had to be on pretty good form all the time. I then also got my wife Pauline, who is French, had hardly been to England before, and I was appointed to the headmastership of Haileybury a fortnight off before we got married. So it was all a slightly startling event for her, having sort of shaky teacups with governing bodies and that kind of thing. But it meant we only had one term together in as a sort of boarding housemaster plus wife, which I think in a sense was merciful, actually, because it was so all-demanding. And by then one was so embedded in the place that I suppose people have got used to one in a way, and therefore... The leaving of the teaching was more important to me than the leaving of the house, which in a way I just sort of breathed a mighty sigh of relief and thought, well, one's done one's bit and hopefully helped a few people, but it was tremendously demanding. One realised. I mean, I never thought of becoming headmaster. It was again Bob Runcie who cropped up in my life because he was Bishop of St Albans and by default chairman of the governors of Haileybury, and he didn't have any strings to pull. At least I don't think he did. But he did crop up in my life again significantly, and he said, "Well, look, you've been at Charterhouse long enough. Why don't you have a go at Haileybury?" And Haileybury was a splendid place in some ways, but it was really back in the dark ages. I mean, it had shrugged off the Imperial Service College, sort of, but still the link was there, and it was still called Haileybury and Imperial Service College in its full glory. And it was... exclusively boarding. I mean, each boarding house was a dormitory full of 60 beds. That was it. There were no studies or anything like that at all. It was pretty claustrophobic, built around a sort of Cambridge college, as a Cambridge college by the architect of the National Gallery and of Pembroke College at Cambridge. Lovely, beautiful countryside, 30 miles from the centre of London, but inward-looking, as it were, and a little bit, dare one say it, self-congratulatory. I mean, if you played rugby football heroically and went to chapel several times a day, you would be saved, and if you didn't, you might not be. Academically, not wildly stimulating, but still great to teach, and again, with the handful of very clever kids who weren't perhaps getting a terribly good deal, in a way. It was about as different from Charterhouse and later as of Westminster as a school could be. And it was wonderful in lots of ways. Again, there were wonderful people there. It was very close-knit, but it could, at its best, it had the benefit of that, of a sort of big family feel, as it were, about it. One spent 10 pretty demanding years there trying to sort of nudge it reasonably painfully towards the early stages of the 20th century, as it were. It was rather like what an Indian school would like to be, namely sort of Sandhurst in the 1920s, and against which one did one's little bit to try to, in a sense, prevent or develop from. And it was quite tough going. I mean, not everybody wanted Haileybury to be changed, needless to say, but the parents were changing. They were, again, first tended to be increasingly first-generation parents, much more demanding. It coincided with a time when the independent school was being pretty seriously questioned. Finances were going up. What was the value of it? If you bought it, then you were expecting the school to do its stuff, as it were. And if it didn't, then... And so there was a little bit of a sort of tug of war between nothing must change, the old houses must go on, the old rigorous ways of... rather like Sherburn sort of in the 1940s, 50s and so on. And those who actually were open-eyed enough to see that things actually did need to change. And one was lucky enough to find, at that stage, a very, very good group of young people coming into teaching, amongst whom one can now number the sort of former High Master of Manchester Grammar School and of St Paul's and the Dragon School and various things. So it's been nice to feel that one gave something of a start to people who sort of benefited from it ultimately and saw, what we were trying to do instead of just being ground to the earth by tradition and precedent.
You were a very young headmaster, really, in the great scheme of things, and you must have felt, therefore, that you were going to have to move somewhere else at some point rather than staying there.
Yes. That's a very... Again, a very interesting question, Tom, looking back on it. I didn't sort of want to be a headmaster, actually, because even then the sort of sense of... I suppose loss of freedom was something to do with it, really. But, of course, in those days, I mean, one hadn't a clue. There were no training courses. HMC was a shambles, basically. For whatever it stood for, it certainly didn't help new headmasters when there was no attempt to sort of tell you what to do or how to do it or whatever. And so one went into it very much as sort of one or two other friends around about that time, very much sort of feeling, well, we were the sort of the last generation of the amateurs, as it were. And one lived and learned by experience a bit. And so, again, the idea of sort of plotting out careers, which has obviously become much more significant in many ways, hence the multiplicity of posts, which now seem to exist within schools, didn't really sort of impinge at all. One took it by the moment, in a way, and I think in no case, I mean, either leaving India to go to Chard House or leaving Chard House to go to Haileybury, did I really think very much about the next step. I was well aware that there were some people who had been at schools for far too long, so I knew that one shouldn't be there far too long, though there was no limit then set upon one's tenure. And it's funny how sort of chance plays, I mean, timing plays such an amazing part in everything, really, because I suppose I had just begun to start thinking of, I'm not sure I can do very much more here, somebody else needs to do it, because you get sort of embedded in the various sort of problems and their resolution or irresolution, as it were, and so you're always preparing the way for the next blow, as it were, in a sense. You're making appointments, the fulfilment of which will be when your successor has turned up, and so on. And I suppose you come not exactly to lose the impetus and the energy or the focus, or whatever it is, but just the sort of sense that I mustn't go on doing the same thing again and again and again. And then again, I'd not given a thought to Westminster at all. I'd not thought that it was the sort of... I'd forgotten my aunt's injunction. I'm not sure that I ever thought that, you know, I'd been to central London and all that, and well, my wife was a Parisian, and there's nothing better than central London by comparison with Paris. But no, it was a complete fluke, actually, really, in many ways.
What were your impressions of Westminster at that time? You know, having been in Charterhouse and Haileybury for so long, you must
yes.
have come across Westminster's and...
Yes,
there was a
distinct dislike between Carthusians and Westminsters, which I remember vividly, partly because the pink seemed to come into both schools in strange ways. And yet, as I say, the nearest thing that, when I arrived here, the nearest thing that I'd come across before was it precisely Charterhouse. Lots of rather difficult and precocious people, as it were, wanting to go their own ways.
You're talking about the common room.
I'm talking eventually about both. No, it was interesting. Because, I mean, I knew that Westminster, the Evening Standard, had written an article saying sort of who was going to be appointed and who was sort of in the frame. In those days, these things appeared to be hit the columns of the press and so on. And so we were all told very sort of carefully who was going to succeed John Ray, because John, of course, inevitably hit the press as in his departure, as in his presence. I was just contacted by a wonderful man whom you may remember called Burke Trend, Secretary to the Cabinet for many years. He was the Common Room Governor, I think, funnily enough. I was rung up by Burke Trend, and he said, come and have dinner. So in the conventional way that one does, one went and had dinner with Burke Trend and another governor at one of these clubs. And by that stage, they got down to sort of four or five people, I think. And so we talked, and I must say, he was such an impressive man that I thought that if he's actually involved in the school, then... If they are interested, well, I why not? Nothing to lose. So I sort of put my hat metaphorically into the ring at the sort of final selection, just of the sort of penultimate thing with the sort of selection committee, chaired by Edward Carpenter, Dean, who spoke mainly about poetry and the Abbey, and was asked a few ferocious questions by various people, and... tottered out of Lee Bolton and Lee's offices where all this took place. not having a clue as to what was going on. Anyway, I was then sort of invited to come back for the sort of last two interviews, at which moment Pauline had just given birth to Tristan, who was then looked after in an antechamber of the Jerusalem chamber by her mother as she was breastfeeding at the time, while I sort of faced the assembled might of the governors. And it was, in a way, it was quite easy because I didn't think I was really a sort of, in a sense, serious candidate. I didn't know who the other bloke was, but I knew he'd been sort of lined up anyway. So it was quite easy until, I think I probably told you before, there was an Indian canon called Sebastian Charles who asked a question of immense length and very deeply oriental subtlety, which I simply didn't understand at all. So I sort of waffled away for a little while and at the end rather tamely said, I'm not sure if this answers your question. At which moment the assembled governors all roared with laughter, so they clearly had spent years failing to decipher what Canon Sebastian Charles was all about. So, and then the next thing happened, I sort of pottered back to Haileybury and with Pauline and the babe, and a telephone call about 10 o'clock in the evening from Edward Carpenter, and I had no idea what he was saying. He was a sort of lovely, sort of unworldly figure. And I didn't know whether he was saying, I'm terribly sorry you haven't been appointed, or I'm terribly sorry you have been appointed. And I had to ring up the bursar the next day to say, can you tell me what's happened? To go back to your question after a long digression, it was fascinating, really, because It wasn't as good as it thought it was. I mean, it was. I must define that a little bit more carefully. I mean, academically, it was not huge shakes. I mean, there weren't any sort of league tables and so on, but not everybody did actually automatically get into Oxford and Cambridge, and a lot of people thought they were frightfully good, and I'm not sure they were as good. I mean, reading those first essays, they weren't actually all that much better than a Haileybury essay at A level, you know. And some of the teaching was made a virtue of being sort of distinctive and challenging and compelling and all that sort of stuff, but I'm not sure that it got anywhere terribly much except for the self-satisfaction of the teacher, in a way. Now, that's putting it very sardonically, because, I mean, overall, it was absolutely fantastic. I arrived in the summer term, hence everything was done, there was nothing much to do. I inherited the first black girl head of school, which was John Ray's last sort of whim. And instead, John had been a friend and became a better friend, as it were, thereafter, and was absolutely wonderful. And a wonderful schoolmaster, I mean, betrayed by his own longing for publicity in a way, and a sad loss to the nation's political educational life, actually, too, which he ought to have gone into after, well, tried to go into after Westminster. But it was a bit sort of brittle. It was sort of, you know, whenever I came up once or twice sort of before, and everything, I mean, John stage managed a fantastic row on the steps of 17 Dean's Yard, sort of on the staircase, with some obviously rather difficult youth, as it were. It was actually a tremendous performance. And then he asked me to come into Latin prayers, which was fun, which was a kind thought. And he gave an absolutely brilliant sort of denunciatory talk about how people were mistreating college hall servants and that kind of thing. Completely stage managed, but you could hear a pin drop. It was most impressive. So one sort of had a kind of glimpse of it, and it was nice because one could take a turn to sort of take the temperature a bit. I mean, I used to sort of, not being at all familiar with London, I used to sort of potter about on the underground and think that I could sort of see what people were up to. And every time I sort of questioned a manifestly Westminster boy, they'd always just been sent by Mr. So-and-so to study a Roman coin at the British Museum or something. So every time I tried to make an arrest, it was totally useless. So I gave that up very rapidly. And I'd also been warned by an old Haileyburian who happened to be the president of the common room here that John Ray had been seen far too often in the common room and so on, and therefore keep out sort of thing. And it didn't take long to realise that actually what one felt the place needed in a funny sort of way is just somebody not actually sort of drawing attention to himself all the time, but being around a bit. In other words, being in the common room, so you didn't have people storming up the stairs to complain about everything all the time. But just sort of diffusing everything, being out in the yard and chatting to people if one could at the relevant moments. And that became the sort of most important thing in a funny sort of way, I think, rather than, I mean, there were nothing needed to be done in a way. The great machine was rolling and, you know, the exam results actually got better and better and better, and the teachers got better and better and better. And London being London presented its huge challenges like the IRA and that sort of thing. It was like, it's a rather stale image now, but I used to feel in the sort of boarding school world, you were sort of, you set off early on Monday morning on a sort of week-long marathon, and you tottered in late on Sunday night, as it were, and set off again the next Monday morning. And that was it, relentless steamrolling stuff. And every time you walked out into the quadrangle, yet another problem sort of arose, etc. Here, it was much more like sort of running sort of 100-yard sprints a day. And things didn't linger. I mean, that was a wonderful thing I thought about. It was that sort of explosions occurred and then disappear. They were very seldom long-lasting. I mean, they could become so in terms of personalities and so on. But most things blew up and over with remarkable rapidity. And it's not that people were sort of more self-concerned, so they ultimately couldn't care less about what was going on forever. It was just that, you know, I mean, what was manifest was that everybody absolutely loved teaching, wanted to do it, loved doing it in London, because London was a wonderful sort of educational experience, etc. And therefore, life moved on at sort of London's pace in a sort of way. And that was immensely, immensely stimulating, I think. So one, and that's what one still, 18 years after the event, sort of misses, was the sort of hurdy-burly and the sort of cut and thrust of it all, not the endless sort of, oh dear, the school year is beginning again. I yet again have to address the common room or address the parents about this, that, or the other. And, I mean, I think the other thing was that, I mean, both at Haileybury, and in a way it was a little bit of a training, Haileybury had been totally dominated by my predecessor there, who was a terrific sort of gun-slinging strider up and down of touchlines and leader of congregational singing and all that sort of stuff, and a totally estimable man of the sort of old school of good headmastering which existed in those days. I suppose in a funny sort of way, sort of in a way coming here was slightly similar, that one had to get used to the idea, and furthermore at Haileybury, one wanted to give the good people the chance. The very good men and women joined the staff. One didn't want them to be dominated by these older figures for whom change spelt disaster, as it were. And here, one felt it was obviously quite different because everybody was so frightfully busy going their own ways. But it was dominated by John, notwithstanding the powerful personalities of Jim Cogan and John Field and all that sort of stuff, but they were sort of, in a sense, in his image as well. So it was all a bit brittle with sort of people, and the kids themselves, I think, feeling they could do what the hell they liked, because that's on the whole what the common room was doing, and in a way that's what John Ray was doing, was sort of... and yet, everybody linked by a sort of, you know, a passionate devotion to Westminster, which was great. So one wanted to try to find ways of encouraging people to do just that, to do what they were good at and they enjoyed doing, and they do it a damn sight better, etc., etc. And that would spill down to the kids themselves, so they didn't feel sort of dominated by what you might call the arrogance of some of the styles of some teachers, basically. And once they realised that the brilliance of the teachers was there for them, rather than to show off the teacher's own brilliance, a sort of sea change took place in a way.
You did, of course, appoint a number of, you know, very significant colleagues, some of whom are still here.
Yes.
Today. I was wondering, what were you really looking for in appointing new staff to Westminster?
I think it was strangely similar to selecting girls, actually, oddly enough, in the sense that they needed to be sort of robust, sure enough of themselves without actually being arrogant, and one used to have these sort of titanic CVs that came in of men and women who'd done everything under the sun, usually postponing the evil hour when they actually had to do something, with endless degrees and endless sort of research whatnots and so on all over the place. And it always, I really found it terribly difficult, actually, because one had so little to go on. I mean, we weren't much good in those days at sort of practice classes and sort of endless interviews. And I mean, even headmasters were appointed almost haphazardly, you know, with governing bodies not having the faintest idea, and sometimes then sort of failing to support the person that they had chosen over a year or so before. But history was littered with that sort of accident in those days. And it's the same with, I mean, we had no hierarchies then. There was an undermaster, there was a director of studies, there were heads of departments and housemasters, nothing else at all. And so one used to rely very much on the head of department, director of studies giving a sort of pretty objective view, though not an expert one necessarily. It didn't sort of depend on what subject it all was. The undermaster came into it invariably as a kind of sort of guide, but it was pretty amateur, I suspect, by comparison. I suppose one just had a bit of a hunch. I mean, I can think of some people who didn't have terribly good qualifications by comparison with others, who one just felt would sort of fit in terribly well, in the way that I suppose I slightly felt myself that I didn't know what I was coming to, as it were, and somehow one had to sort of try to show one wasn't being totally bowled over by it. And it was rather the same with these people. And I suppose one learnt to distinguish between those who were sort of puffing their chests a little bit too much, because they were still very good. We didn't have, I mean, people wanted to come, basically, so we didn't have terribly many "please comes," because we were come because we can't do without you sort of thing, and then being turned down. I can't recall very many of those, so on the whole we got the people we wanted, and I suppose the right sort of opportunities appeared, I think. The difficulties came more, I mean, in a sense, with housemastering, I think, as a sort of more difficult and again kind of appointment. And of course now some schools are appointing housemasters from outside, which seems very bizarre.
Seems
it's very extraordinary. Boarding schools doing that.
It seemed to me, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this, but as a pupil, it seemed to me that there were housemasters at that time who were if you like, consciously appointed to reform the House.
Yes.
Really.
Yes.
And several of whom did a remarkably good job at that, actually. Would that be in any way an accurate perception?
Yes. One of the good things, in a sense, is that if... I mean, in a way, it's much less demanding being a day house master than what I was trying to describe before. But actually coming to feel that there were people who wanted to do it and enjoyed doing it, as it were, and particularly I can think of two people who set up houses, as it were, from scratch. And it wasn't, unlike being in the boarding school world of those days, it was there weren't ladders, basically. There was nothing very much you could become. You could become head of department, or you could become a housemaster, and the two were usually separate. So there were two completely different ladders. You went up a pastoral ladder, you went up an academic ladder. And so here, housemaster was never really seen as a sort of step up to great things outside, in a way. It's now obvious to become... I mean, then there was a sort of great thing about sort of second master, deputy headmasters or second masters or headmasters, academics or pastoral or whatever. All that has become much more sort of career opportunity. So one felt that the people who eventually did it because they quite wanted to do it and did it extremely well. And a lot of it was very much based on the sort of academic, but clearly also, I mean... in central London in the days when you were here, I mean, the needs of individual pupils were manifestly colossal, about which we knew so terribly, terribly, terribly little. And probably the housemasters or individual teachers in individual classrooms were the only people who got to the bottom of anything very much. I mean, it was very much the sort of syndrome of the absent home, the kids pushing off at Saturday lunchtime to nothing except an expensive pad in Highgate or Hampstead or wherever it happened to be, with the parents having sworn that they would be there, not being there at all. And the only people who could pick that up, basically, were either housemasters or the wretched teacher at sort of 9 o'clock on Monday morning, seeing a rather bedraggled creature turning up in front of him. But it was much easier. I can only say that I'm very grateful having, in a way, got out just in time before it all became so much more professional and efficient and that sort of thing. I mean, looking back on that first Ofsted inspection, it was really just a complete laugh. I mean, equally, the first league tables in which Westminster came top, the very first league levels, and so, but completely, the successive governments have made all this fuss about league tables. The moment Westminster came top, it sort of vanished. They weren't the slightest bit interested. But the Ofsted was fascinating, really, because I suppose we were chosen by convenience, because we were where we were. And again, I think I probably told you before, but in came these really rather good professional people. The only one, as I say, being a complete dud was the independent school man. And the way in which our teachers sort of grudgingly, but eventually and rather humbly, came to rather admire these chaps and thought, well, actually, they have seen quite a lot and they do appreciate what we're trying to do, and they're not there just to say, you must be doing this, that or the other according to the norm. But then, of course, it all became comic, because we had no policies about anything. We had none of the sort of great echelon of sort of experts on this, that, or the other. David Custance and I, it must have been Eddie Smith, I suppose, and I sort of concocted all these policies, which had never seen the light of day before, about this, that, or the other, and fed them into Ofsted. And again, we were lucky to be saved by Ofsted producing a draft of the report, which was had got all its figures sort of garbled. So we had 650 pupils taking Greek A level, and only 3 pupils in the school. And the word "separate" was misspelt, I remember, about 5 times on one sheet of paper, all from Ofsted. So it became hilarious, but. But it was quite a good learning exercise, and actually, looking back at what you were saying earlier, in a funny sort of way, it didn't do us much harm in a way. It did actually show that there is a world outside. And that was always the slight danger, that we were so busy patting ourselves on the back and thinking we're all frankly brilliant. And there were others very brilliant elsewhere, which was nice, and we could be brilliant as well, why not?
Because you mentioned the big change that's happened more recently with sort of senior management teams and all these new positions. But one change that did happen early in your time here was when the Undermaster role was split from Master of the Queen's Scholars. And I suppose was that a reflection of the sort of complexity of that Undermaster's job at that sort of early stage of the process?
Yes, I'd forgotten that was historically when it happened, was it?
Yes. It was 87, if I remember right.
Was it? Yes.
But I suppose maybe inherited Jim Cogan.
Well, I inherited Jim as both, of course, and at the risk of gossip, was ordered by the governors to kick Jim Cogan out of his house in college and assume it as the headmaster's house, which I wisely decided would not be a very sensitive move. I can't quite remember the history. So it was when Jim retired from college, as perforce he had to after 15 years, did we then divide the post?
Yes, I think it may have happened over a year or something,
And had the massive presence of Tristram, of course, to take over as... I'd forgotten, honestly, that that's when the Undermaster began, because I thought there was a provision for the Undermaster in the statutes, but not.
It was complicated, I think, because they had abolished the office of Undermaster under the statutes and replaced him with a Master of the Queen's Scholars,
yes.
And then the title Undermaster came back after the Second World War.
Fulfilled both, yes. Yes. I think one was conscious of the fact that one did need somebody else. I mean, it was too much, really. It was too easy to make mistakes, particularly with the eyes of the press potentially agog at any moment, as it were, which, we weren't beloved of the Evening Standard always, as it were. I certainly do remember feeling very conscious that one needed input from the insights of being at Westminster in a way, and I suspect coming in completely new without really being able to pick up the different threads would have been very difficult, and hence having in a sense both Jim and Tristram was quite an alliance, or not as the case may be, was enormously beneficial, because they had sort of Westminster in their blood in every possible way, as it were, and that was a great, I think, for trying to sort everything out in a way, and to in no way create a new image, but at least to, and I don't think from then onwards one felt in any way sort of under-supported. In some ways it was funny, because it was a much, I mean, in spite of all the sort of potentially disastrous things which happened or could happen, it was a sort of easier job. I suppose it goes partly back to the sense of sort of just trying to keep on one's feet while one could keep on one's feet and deal with everything as and when it happened, supported by the inflexible barrier of Anne, my secretary, as it were, who was a wonderful keeper at bay of many a problem, as it were, and solver of many of them as well. I understand and appreciate what has happened since, which is why, in a sense, I'm glad to have ceased to be a sort of manager of large numbers of people doing important jobs, as it were. And in those days, still the most important, obviously, was was the teaching and the sort of pastoral side of it, I think, really, and one could predominantly sort of concentrate on that and those.
You mentioned not throwing Jim out of number 3. Of course, you were the last headmaster to live in number 17.
Yes.
What was it like living there, sort of above the shop, as it were?
Well, it was fascinating. I mean, and it was, in a sense, historically. I mean, I think it's rather sad that it has died its death, in a way. I mean, firstly, as a family, we loved it. I mean, my children were 3 and a half, as it were, when they arrived. So Tristan spent virtually the first 18 years of his life sort of here as either child or scholar, as it were. And it was, I mean, it was uncomfortable in a sense. We lived in that sort of flat above. And I always remember another wise thing that Oliver Van Oss always said to me was, stop talking about offices, or don't talk about offices ever, talk about studies. So make your room into a study. And next door to it, we had a drawing room, which admittedly was used for sort of rather pompous occasions on, from time to time, but there it was as a drawing room. One could teach there, actually, too, which I did quite frequently. There was private access through that sort of lift, which got one up to the top. So for Pauline and the children, they could get in and out, as it were, unlike the Queen sort of being seen as she emerged. Well, I suppose she does it by helicopter or whatever. There was an element of privacy, and for the children, actually, it was enormous fun. I mean, they could gaze out of the kitchen window over yard and detect very rapidly what was going on, as it were, which was always illuminating. One took to using the common room entrance as the way in and out, because that was the defusing thing. And I mean, common room was very, very long suffering and nice, actually, because they didn't make one feel that one was invaded. They didn't give the impression that they wanted to sit in corners and complain about the headmaster. Well, there were plenty of other callers they could complain about the headmaster or whoever, without it necessarily being there. And I must say, I felt very much at home there, which was nice. And that's why it's that sort of hurly-burly, epitomised, actually, I suppose, by the sort of the last night of term, the sort of event, the essential sort of bridge of Jim Cogan, John Field and Peter Hughes, and then, you know, sort of bridging away through the night. And then, but there was a very good sort of, at its best, there was a very good atmosphere, and you could also pick up where there were tensions pretty readily, because it was such a scrum. I mean, it was totally inadequate, as everything was. I mean, go back to your day, there was nothing.
Yes, I was going to ask you about this, because, of course, the way that the school has expanded in recent years, of course, soon after you arrived, the Robert Hooke Centre
opened, which was
an amazing development at the time, our pride and joy.
Yeah.
But there were so many other facilities that we lacked.
There was absolutely nothing. I mean, the art school was right up at the top of whatever that building over there at Burnham. Yeah. Bits used underground. I mean, I'm not quite sure where science sort of went on. I must say my heart slightly sank, because the first thing that I was plunged into was the appeal for the Robert Hooke Centre, and I just sort of emerged from Haileybury. Haileybury was similarly penniless. It was founded for the Sons of Hertfordshire Gentlemen and the clergy and armed forces, and had no foundation at all, and depended basically upon old boys to keep going, which was amazing. And here, there was nothing. There was Winnie the Pooh, which kept us financially afloat on the royalties, but couldn't buy us anything at all. There was nothing that we could do, virtually, until they'd identified, hence the appointment of Peter Hughes from a headmastership to become head of science by John Ray, to oversee the stage managing of Robert Hooke. So I came headfirst into this appeal, which was chaired by Robert Carr, the former Home Secretary, who was an absolutely lovely man, who'd been a ball boy at Wimbledon, and used to take me to play at Wimbledon with his with Leonard Cheshire and people like that. Absolutely amazing. He was an MP for the Wimbledon sort of constituency and used to weave around, and he'd pick me up at the back gate, so we slunk out with nobody seeing us. But he was superb, and it transpired that four of the wealthiest men in England were all in the same study at Lidlaw. So Robert Carr just went to them and said, by the way, Gary so-and-so has given $500,000, so you, Lord Sainsbury, will give $500,000, won't you? And so that's how Robert Hooke appeared, out of basically four very generous donations and very well stage managed by Peter Hughes. I mean, wonderfully well, and may I say as an afterthought, as it were, too, that the Peter and his successor, who I suppose was Rob Bevan, whom I appointed, were wonderfully good at preventing their scientists from brewing scientific tea, stroke poison, as it were, in the science building, and forcing them to become part of the Commons. In Haileybury, I had a science lab which was off, away from all the other teaching, and it was very easy for the scientists to sort of just become a kind of inbred science world, for all its qualities, as it were, and again, some very, very good teaching, but they got a bit cut off from the rest of the world, and hence science got cut off from the rest of the world, which I think never happened here, and I hope never has. But it's a difficulty. It's
challenging, because yeah. I mean, also with all the other buildings that we've acquired since, it has fragmented the common room.
Yes. Well, you see, it was, I mean, it bred a kind of, I mean, a sort of community spirit, I suppose, that we were all at such close quarters. And the first thing that I suppose we were able to do was move art over to Sutcliffe's. And we then, basically all we could afford was trying occasionally to buy houses to house staff, because that was the other growing problem, really. As London got more and more expensive, who was ever going to be able to come live and work here without it being a gigantic problem? So that was perceived as a need which we could just about manage. But of course, I mean, in a sense, historically, the other parents were paying for the scholars without anybody knowing it, as it were, really. And we really just kept afloat by that. I mean, the transformation is mind-boggling. I've always rather loved the idea of sort of fitting things into spaces and buildings. So each time I've left a school, it has always happened that they've come into money since, as it were. But it strikes me as being wonderfully well spent, anyway.
You did mention that the new houses a few minutes ago, because of course Hacklett's opened very early in your time as headmaster, and then Milne's opened towards the end.
Yes.
What were the challenges of establishing new houses within the school when we had really very little space and we were not acquiring new buildings?
I mean, that was the problem, really. I mean, it was both the problem and an attempt at a solution. The problem was that the houses, existing houses, were overcrowded and too much for... I can't really remember, and you will know better than I do, were the numbers going up?
I suppose they were.
There were girls.
When I was in the fifth form, we were a six form intake.
Yeah.
And previously it had been five.
So yeah.
I think there was a bulge.
We had a bulge. That's exactly right. Yes. But I mean, also, I mean, it's related to the same problem is that we met actually four times a week in the Abbey, as the whole school. Well. Most of those. And we also met up school and just about fitted in, as it were. So there were, and this is unlike the boarding school, there were sort of four occasions a week, basically, when the whole school at least came together. I suppose one began to feel that the day houses got too big and too unwieldy. The mixture of day and boarding was always a little bit of a problem, though could become a great benefit in some ways. It's rather a good sort of mixed blessing in a way. Fitting Hakluyt in was of course a major problem because it couldn't have been in a way less well placed. I mean, it's very well placed in one sense, but I don't know where it is now. Is it
same place?
The same place. And it took a fairly sort of larger than life personality to sort of sweep the board, which David Cook was. And a great supporter, I may say, too, actually. And it was easy to support him because he had manifest enthusiasms, which, on the whole, occasionally had to be tempered. But especially
in the history classroom.
Especially in the history classroom. But he carved a way through, as it were, and gave it an identity as well as an unpronounceable name for most people. But it sort of... I still wonder whether that was right or not, but still. And the same, I suppose, with Milnes, really. John was a terrifically good, in a sense, old-fashioned housemaster with a sort of beliefs of actually looking after children and sort of helping them to do their best in whatever way it happened to be. And I think he loved the sort of pioneering thing, to the extent that he doesn't want to go on being housemaster in any respect ever after, as it were, because he's done his bit and nothing will be quite like it again. And I think it did help to sort of diffuse things. It sort of brought the numbers down to more manageable sizes so that the established sort of Ashburn and Dryden's Rents and so on, terribly ill-housed, really, in terms of sort of... Could people really be sort of looked after in such a sort of hurly-burly as that was? It made it a little bit more manageable. At least gave the housemaster sort of less excuse not to look after the kids that they were supposed to be in charge of, really.
One of the other things you mentioned, sport. And, I mean, I remember you were playing for the Common Room hockey team in your last year as headmaster, which you won. I should just add this. But clearly you really enjoyed that, and you were playing hockey, playing tennis, you were very involved in...
Well, I felt it was a way of sort of meeting people on common ground, basically. I mean, just like teaching. I wasn't teaching terribly well by the end of it all, and particularly there were brilliant teachers around one. But one wanted to be doing what everybody else was doing, in a way, and here, above all, if one wasn't in a classroom, then one didn't know what really the life of the school was like, actually. And the games, even the squash court up at the top of the Robert Hooke Centre, were a way of fitting in with the, you know, one's fellow playing cricket on a Sunday with the sort of pink elephants, whatever it was. It was a way of just sort of doing whatever other people were doing, and also meeting the boys and girls on sort of common ground. So all those endless sort of, was it netball that we tried to play rather incompetently. I think all that mattered, and sort of tennis with Richard Stokes, and I don't think we ever lost, actually. We were sort of glad to say it, as we both retired. It was good, and it also kept one reasonably sort of normal and sane in a way. It was a way of sort of slightly getting out of the study, as it were, and doing. And again, I mean, what was always rather fun about Westminster was that people could do things which in other schools would be immensely sort of distinctive, but here, you could kick a football and play a Beethoven piano concerto sort of standing on your head, as it were. I mean, there were immensely talented people around, and yet glory, particularly on the sporting field, was won rather lightly, which was rather nice, and people weren't sort of out to prove that they could score thousands more runs than anybody else, as it were. And they just took the skills reasonably well. I'm not sure that everybody would agree about footballers, but on the whole, I think that was the refreshing thing about it. It wasn't a kind of religion. It was just something like playing Hamlet or or playing Beethoven's Fifth Piano Concerto, whatever it was, and that's why I quite liked, rather inadequately, to sort of have a go at producing a play here and there, because it got other people involved, and we were doing the same sort of thing, and it was a little bit sort of selfish in a way, because it meant that sort of from 4 o'clock in the afternoon to 6 o'clock in the afternoon, I could be doing that and nothing else, as it were. But it was very rewarding, and of course the sort of ease with some of these very talented pupils sort of took there. I mean, Alistair Sook, for example, who played part of the Duke in Measure for Measure, which I did in my last year in the Dungeons. That was the other. Is it? No, is that what it's still called? Yes. I mean, Alistair was just amazing because, I mean, nobody at Westminster bothered to learn their part, as it were, at all, to the very last moment. But Alistair just knew everybody's part right from the word go. So whenever he was on stage, which was throughout, basically, he was able to either quote their lines or invent Shakespeare or speak his own. And it, you know, just did it as if it was to the manner born. It was magnificent. And that was always refreshing and rather humbling, actually, too, to see the skills that were... And the music was just staggering, too, and wonderful.
One of the things we haven't really touched upon is the Abbey. Of course,
yes.
Being part of the community and living in Dean's Yard and as headmaster, the Abbey, I think, meant a lot to you.
Yeah.
As part of that.
Yes, it did, and I'm glad to say I think it meant quite a lot to the large majority of people who lived and worked here, actually, too. I mean, particularly of the adolescent generation, as it were, without them showing it, and it only perhaps came through afterwards, as in the case of my own children. The relations with practically everybody outside Westminster when I first arrived were reasonably fraught. A long series of running battles between various members of the Common Room and various representatives of the Abbey, rather thinly papered over by Deal Carpenter, who was sort of more otherworldly, as it were. And so the were tensions, and of course he retired before I arrived, and we had a sort of interregnum year, which was actually rather magnificently presided over by the then Dean of Christchurch, Eric Heaton, who I remember saying to me once, sort of at last, as a governor, we have the opportunity to do some governing, which either meant that I needed to be looked after or that John Ray had not shown any will to be governed at all. I think it was absolutely deeply embedded in the life of the school, and hence one fought to retain the links of the Abbey. Michael Main, who eventually overcame his ME and came as Dean, was a wonderful human being, as I think I've also said to you before. And when there were tragedies which occurred, that certainly had done in his life and occasionally in mine, he was just wonderful. But he wasn't terribly comfortable with the double umbrella, as it were, of Abbey and school. And I didn't feel that I could take the school to him very much. It was mainly a question of trying to bring the Abbey and its representatives to the school to make them realise it wasn't quite so nasty, vicious and whatever else it might be as they thought, or indeed even as rowdy, or only on a few occasions as rowdy. And to make them feel sort of more welcome and hope that they would make us feel more welcome in a way. And it took a little bit of time. And we were quite lucky in that we got on with people like Bishop Nat Fisher, who most people in the school didn't, but Pauline and I did. He took the confirmations and so on. And,
he confirmed me.
Did he? Yes. He would have done, because he succeeded the lovely Lancelot Fleming, a former Bishop of Norwich, who was a wonderful sort of polar explorer and a kind of legend among, in the school world, particularly as well as the bishop world. But the troops here didn't greatly care for Bishop Nat Fisher because they saw him as he'd weathered a heck of a lot of storms in South Africa. He was even Bishop of Cape Town or somewhere. Was a scholarly and wise man. But there were elderly canons who were rather reclusive and wanted the abbey to be on their own terms, resented us in Ashburnham House, the fact that the dungeons, etc., they had no means of sort of watering or feeding their flock, etc., etc. Michael, because of his human qualities, I think became much better known within the... he liked looking after the choir school, and I think was very, very good at it. And he, I suspect, would not have been sorry to have retired from the school to a particularly cruel death, actually. So I only had a year of Wesley Carr, who was an interesting person. I better be careful what I say. Undervalued by some within the abbey, regarded, I think, with sort of veiled respect from the school side, because he was actually an educationalist and very much so, and actually rather enjoyed the school, and I would have been quite glad to work under him, though I find him very, very difficult. And I admired, actually, his intellect, as, strange enough, did my children, who sort of... He was very diffident about how he, well or badly, he kept on saying, I can't speak anything like as well as my predecessor. And in fact, he spoke in a completely different voice, which was very, very eloquent and shrewd. The personal relationships were always a little bit touch and go. Receiver generals also came and went and were a little bit influential because on the whole they disapproved of what was going on, and rear admirals don't take all that kindly always to adolescent schoolboys and girls. So it didn't always go terribly well. But fundamentally, I think quite a number of others felt that the heart of the whole school actually was the abbey, and hence the heritage, which I hope was never quite forgotten or overlooked. And I think it did weave its way into what happened here. I mean, people were very courteous and polite in the abbey, no doubt having to listen to all kinds of weird things being spoken to them. But again, once one got more of the teachers involved, so that different voices were heard, in a sense saying the same things but in different ways, the level of sort of tolerance, understanding, acceptance, if not belief, came to matter, I think, in a way.
The last thing I do need to ask you about is, because after retirement you then became a Westminster parent.
Yes.
And so another role completely, another vantage point.
Yes.
Were there any challenges in that, suddenly coming to parents' evenings?
There were, which one did one's... I mean, the most difficult thing, I think, was the fact that one had made lots of friends, one had to sort of try and draw a little bit of a line between seeing one's friends and colleagues, as I very much regard them as, particularly of the English department, where we were a slight race apart, as it were. Distinguishing between that and, in a sense, being an official parent. Mercifully, I was spared quite a lot by Pauline, who was very sort of very good at sort of both keeping the sort of rapport with people and at the same time sort of looking after R2's interests in a way. One of the great things about being lucky enough to sort of live not a million miles away was the fact that here we are in London, and just as I found when we first arrived, so I found when we first left, everybody melts into London. There was a rather marvellous moment when I realised I didn't have to apprehend boys smoking in distant but well-known places, or indeed my own children doing it. And I think the... Tristram was awfully kind at sort of asking one back when it sort of when it seemed to be helpful from the point of view of being a parent. And I had to be careful not to, I think probably to a fault, I withdrew, as it were, because, we didn't have great conclaves about this, that, or the other, as it were, and I used to sort of pop in a couple of times a term to have a stiff drink with him, as it were, down in whatever that little house was. But not in any sense other than just to sort of give him a breather, I think. And I saw the school in a different perspective, there's no doubt about that. In some ways one was glad one knew so little, which it made me realise that one did know remarkably little. But in other ways it was also very comforting, because actually all the strong qualities within the school were brought out in both my children's education. One, a daughter who who'd been at a sort of very tightly knit and supposedly highly academic girls only boarding school, which I must say was, I came to think was education almost at its worst. And to see how she was opened up, for better or worse, by what Westminster had to offer and the ways in which she and a number of her, we were very unpopular, as it were, at her girls' school, because about 20 of her friends came with her to Westminster. But it was it was very warming to see how, again, with no holds barred, a person who'd been rather stifled by a sort of claustrophobic academic atmosphere, and not much of a pastoral one either, was sort of opened up in exactly the right ways, both intellectually and socially and in terms of skills and so on, by fine and dedicated teaching. And very much the same with Tristan too, I think. It could have been awful for him, sort of coming as a boarder, parents living sort of in a sense just up the road, having grown up at the under school and as son of the headmaster and all that sort of thing. And again, it goes back to the sense of people taking things in their stride, I think, in a way, and sort of age differences didn't seem to matter as much here and as they do in some schools. There are no great sort of hierarchies of pecking out order and people being that much more brilliant than somebody else or whatever. And everybody being freer to live their own lives, even in the rather claustrophobic nature of college, where he was very lucky with his fellow scholars. It was just a fantastic year, and they've been the closest of friends ever since. But it wasn't difficult. The only difficulty was just sort of making sure one did withdraw, really. And it was tempting sometimes to sort of feel that life hadn't come to an end. And of course, nowadays, I was asked to stay on for 2 years and stayed for one, which was when the children came. It would be more difficult if if, as now, one could have stayed for a longer period of time. But time was up, I think, anyway. It was right. There were things that were just beginning to sort of loom over the horizon that I would not have been equipped to deal with, and the modern headmaster is, I think. And I better not go into that.
Well, I think at this stage we normally ask whether there's anything else you would like to add.
I've waffled far too much, I think.
Oh, no, it's been absolutely marvellous.
No, I don't think there are, no. I remember thinking it at the time, and I suppose I thought it occasionally ever since. You only actually learn to be a reasonably good headmaster once you've stopped doing it. But I wouldn't qualify my last statement. I think one or two close friends of about the same age, or a bit younger, who stayed on at the head of sort of places like Radley and so on. It was becoming a different world, really, from the one that we thought we knew a tiny little bit about, because we'd grown up in it through experience, as it were, going back to your first questions, from sort of childhood onwards. One understood that sort of school and what it needed to become. And now there are people who've had a different background of experience and have worked their ways through that, up different ladders, there are now ladders, whereas there weren't. And are better equipped, really, probably, to deal with the kind of difficulties which came one's way, which were almost always unexpected and almost always had to be dealt with on the spur of the moment. So in a sense it was a feeling of rightness, I think, that it had come to an end in a way.
Oh, thank you.
She's remained silent ever since. She's just been grinning and grinning.
I often don't let